a rather well-publicized case a couple of weeks back in Miami, in which a high school principal actually brought students in and threatened them with discipline because they were using the social media platform Instagram to call attention to the fact that the school food was covered with mold and the walls and the ceilings were covered with mildew and that the school was essentially filthy. And the students were using Instagram in this sort of very rudimentary journalistic way, in the way that people might in an earlier time have used pamphlets or other forms of journalistic speech. These students resorted to Instagram. They were hauled into the principal's office and they were told they were making the school look bad and that they were not to publicize these defects.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, here today with Amber Healy. Amber didn't take part in this particular podcast, but she's in studio, so I thought she'd help me do the intro here. This podcast is about, well, it's a conversation with Frank Lamont of the Student Press Law Center. And we talk a bit about student rights, student journalism rights, and how there's some censorship going on out there. So were you a student journalist, Amber?
I was. At St. Bonaventure, I worked on the Bonaventure, which was our student newspaper, very clever title.
For the Bonnies.
Lovingly known as the BV for those of us who work there. Yeah, and it was a requirement of the journalism program at Bonaventure to take media law.
Did you have any particular run-ins with censorship at Bonaventure?
No, in a different sort of way. I'm not sure if this is something that you all touched on in the conversation, but there was an on-campus protest about the new core curriculum that they were bringing in at Bonaventure at the time. And I was a member of the BV staff, but I was not covering the curriculum changes. And I was involved in the protest, and my editors there saw me, who were student editors, obviously. And they gave me a hard time, but the advisor stood up for me and said that since I wasn't covering the story, I could in fact be a part of the protest.
You could actually have a voice. Well, that was good for you. I didn't do journalism in college. I did do it in high school. Nancy Davis was my instructor. She helped me sort of find my love for journalism and start me on that path, and ended up at Indiana University School of Journalism. And that's another long, very story. I did want to mention before we get into this podcast a couple of things. You could always find out more about us at itsalljournalism.com and also follow us on Twitter at alljournalism. I recently put together a list of all of our guests, their Twitter handles. There's a list there on at All Journalism. So go ahead and follow them or follow the list. It's a way for you to sort of follow up on the conversations here. But let's begin our podcast with Frank Lamont. Executive Director the Student Press Law Center.
Right.
So first of all, tell me what the Student Press Law Center is.
Well, the Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit legal aid organization. It was set up 40 years ago to be a source of legal information and support and advocacy for people working in student journalism around the country. So we work with students from middle school all the way up through graduate school. We get about 2,500 calls and emails a year from people around the country who need help with some question about their legal rights.
Okay. And is that how you find out most of the people that you're working with? Is it they contact you, or are there particular issues that you sort of concentrate on?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, the way most people encounter us is by sending a request to us through our website or calling our hotline. We go around a lot on the road to workshops of various kinds, visiting campuses, visiting schools, trying to find out what's going on out there in the evolving world of journalism. So we have a lot of interaction one-on-one with people. I just got back from New York City. I was teaching some workshops up there for college journalists, and in a couple of weeks I'll be in Denver doing the same for high school journalists. So we have a lot of one-on-one interaction with people who bring us stories about obstacles and impediments they're running into when they're trying to gather or distribute news.
Are you seeing a lot of the same problems across like middle school, high school, and college? Or are they kind of different with the different age groups?
Well, when somebody calls us from a K-12 school, it's normally a question about their First Amendment rights. Normally, it's I'm being ordered not to publish something that I think I have a right to publish. And unfortunately, some of the censorship is really, really heavy-handed to the point where teachers' jobs are threatened or journalism programs are actually threatened with closure. And those are the cases that, I guess, hit you right in the gut, the ones that actually threaten the existence and the future of journalism. At the college level, the calls tend to be more about access access to records, access to meetings, things like I'm going to a board of trustees or board of regents meeting, and they're telling me that they're going to close the doors and shut the press out of the meeting, and I think I have a right to be in there. What can I do? Or oftentimes these days, there are questions about campus crime, campus discipline, campus sexual assault, and especially the interaction with athletic departments. That's an area that seems like it's a special area of sensitivity and image consciousness among colleges. So it's kind of the perfect storm. You've got a subject that journalists are especially intensely interested in finding out about, and one that the colleges are especially intensely interested in keeping secret.
I'm sure it has nothing to do with the fact that a lot of times those athletic programs tend to be cash cows and also are nice lures for alumni. That's me editorializing on it. So the people who reach out to you in like middle school and high school, I guess maybe to college to a degree, are they primarily students, or do you get advisors, faculty people who reach out to you as well?
Yeah, it's quite a mix. It's probably close to 50-50 teachers and students contacting us because, you know, students tend to come and go. They're not always that attuned to or conscious of their legal rights, but teachers and professors tend to be more aware that at least there might be some legal right, and they're a little less intimidated and less fearful about reaching out and asking for help. I mean, that's one of the things that is really the saddest part of this job, is to see how many times young people are just too frightened to ask for help. They think they might have a legal recourse, that they might have some legal rights that are being violated, but they're just so frightened that if they speak out, if they oppose authority, that some cloud is going to be put on their future. You know, their college admission might be obstructed, or again, their teacher might be fired, their program might be closed down. So it's that implicit fear of retaliation that keeps a lot of people from asserting and protecting their rights.
And it's very problematic. And you sort of touched on it when you were talking about like the colleges and the sports programs and things like that, where you're dealing with not with like a local government, you're dealing with an authority of some sort. You're dealing with a school that's either private or public. But could you sort of explain to us the sort of legal ramifications of being a student journalist? I mean, what freedoms do you have? What censorship is sort of in the system that you might be butting your head up against?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one about which there's a certain amount of uncertainty. You know, Ann Richards, when she was governor of Texas, used to have this great line about how Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did, only she did it backwards and in high heels. And I have said before that student journalists are doing everything that professional journalists are doing, only they're doing it backward and in cement overshoes. They're being asked to cover a lot of the same news that we used to rely on professionals for. And oftentimes, the only person that shows up at a county school board meeting anymore is a high school journalist. And if they don't bring us that information, nobody does. Colleges around the country are being called upon by people like the Knight Foundation to reconceive their journalism program like a teaching hospital, to think of themselves as the frontline provider of that critical information that the community needs. So we're leaning on students, all of us are, to be our information providers. And at the same time, we don't provide them with anything near the same level of legal protection that professionals have. You know, the Supreme Court has told us that the government couldn't stop the New York Times, the Washington Post, from publishing anything short of maybe United States invasion plans that would put the lives of troops in danger. But of course, at the school level and at the college level, students have quite a bit less protection than that. At the private institution level, they have none at all. A private institution isn't governed by the Constitution at all. So a school like Georgetown or GW doesn't have to adhere to any type of constitutional standards. A public institution, say University of Maryland, does have to adhere to First Amendment standards. But even there, the courts have not recognized nearly the same level of protection for students as for professionals. And the school or maybe even the college could step in and could censor them based on some kind of a showing that their coverage is going to in some way be disruptive to the operations of the institution, however that's defined.
And then there's also the federal student privacy statute. How does that play into this?
Yeah. So in 1974, Congress passed this law called FERPA. Some people call it the Buckley Amendment because Senator Buckley was the lead author of it. And it was this very well-intentioned thing that was all about protecting young people against having their records fall into the wrong hands where they might be harmful. And at the time, Buckley and Congress were really concerned about things like psychological tests and aptitude tests. And they were afraid that the police or the CIA or the FBI were going to be trolling around campuses looking for suspicious people based on how they did in their IQ test or their behavioral test. And so they passed this privacy law, FERPA, to keep colleges and schools from kind of wantonly disseminating this information without a good reason. Well, over the years, unfortunately, this very well-intentioned law has morphed into this kind of catch-all excuse for a school or a college to withhold any information at all that they consider harmful to their PR image. You know, the starting point, right, at any public institution, when I do business with a government agency, I'm going to leave a trail of public records. So if I go to court, if I apply for a permit, buy a house, get a marriage license, whatever, all that kind of stuff leaves a trail of public records. But when you interact with a school or a college, they're very resistant to considering those documents to be a matter of public record, and they overclassify records all the time as confidential education records. Just today, I was working on a legal brief that we're filing in Florida with an appeals court down there involving records from the University of Central Florida, where UCF is telling journalists that the records of their investigations into hazing by fraternities are a matter of student confidentiality, and you can't have these records. Well, you know, hazing by fraternities is a public health hazard. It is a public safety issue, and it's certainly not what Senator Buckley and Congress had in mind when they were trying to protect what they called education records. Nobody thinks that the record of an investigation into what is potentially a very serious criminal matter, like a battery or an aggravated assault, nobody thinks of that as educational, and yet colleges across the country are throwing this blanket of FERPA secrecy over them.
Now, is that does that seem to be the, well, the blank, you said the word blanket, is that the thing that's used to put out the fire, that's pretty in most cases?
Yeah, what colleges and K-12 schools do is generally their default answer whenever they're faced with a request for public records is, well, we think these are all confidential education records, and if you think otherwise, you're going to have to get a lawyer and take us to court. And of course, they know that almost nobody will. You know, a public records lawsuit can take years to resolve. I'm involved in one in Georgia right now. We're sitting here in March of 2015. The initial public records request was filed by a college student in July of 2012. So this case is going to celebrate its third anniversary in the Georgia appeals courts before we have a decision as to whether he's entitled to these records. And nobody has that kind of time in journalism. Almost nobody can wait out a government agency that's intent on dragging its feet. And certainly almost nobody has the money to fight it out with a government agency that has free lawyers.
So is it... what recourse do student journalists have?
Well, unfortunately, state public records laws generally provide one and only one recourse, which is that you can take the agency to court. Now, fortunately, the Student Press Law Center has got a network of 180 volunteer attorneys around the country who are willing to take on these cases pro bono, just as our attorney Danny Levitas did down in Georgia, took on this case entirely free of charge and now has 2.5 years worth of free work into it. So it's possible to find a volunteer lawyer to represent you, but there's no guarantee of it. And absent that, really, a student has almost no recourse. You know, there's a very rare student journalist or journalistic organization that has the tens of thousands of dollars that would be necessary to mount a prolonged legal battle against a government agency. So what we're really going to have to rely on ultimately is state legislatures and Congress to get into the act and to kind of even the odds here a little bit. The states need to make it easier to get attorney's fees so that when you sue somebody for public records, you can at least have a fair shot at getting compensated and you're not going into the hole tens of thousands of your own money. And Congress needs to get involved by rewriting that flawed federal privacy statute, FERPA, to make clear that it's only about records that are truly educational in nature and not records about public safety issues or financial issues or athletic scandals.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I can see in many ways that this can be really problematic. I mean, especially when we're talking about, you know, how the journalism industry has contracted so much, then a lot of the community news outlets have dried up. And so, you know, the larger papers are using on, you know, relying on stringers at the colleges to cover games, to cover meetings, to cover special events. And if those student journalists are the only ones who are covering those issues of hazing, of, you know, heaven forbid, a sort of a Virginia Tech type shooting issue, you know, something questions are around student safety, you know, if they're the only ones who are dealing with that, it's problematic if they don't have access to fair and open records.
Yeah, there was this really interesting study came out a couple of months ago from the Pew Research Center that looked at state capital bureaus around the country. And what they found was that 15% of all of the journalists covering state capitals in America are students, 15% of them. The public has never been more reliant on students to bring them their news. And yet students don't have anywhere near the infrastructure supporting them. They don't have a big corporate legal department. They often don't have the full benefit of legal rights. In many states, they don't have the full benefit of the reporter's privilege or reporter shield laws. They can be squeezed for their confidential sources in a way that a paid salaried professional never could. We've got to recognize that the way journalism is being done in the 21st century often is by people not working in kind of a traditional salaried newsroom environment. We've got to bring our legal protections into square with the way journalism is being done today. And legal protections don't square with the way journalism is being done today. They're lagging behind.
When I was working at the Connection newspapers in Northern Virginia, we used the Capital News Service down in Richmond, and we got some great stories, some really insightful interviews on with representatives and following different bills through the legislature. And you know, we wouldn't have had any of that. We didn't have the resources for that. So yeah, you know, these journalists are out there and on these beats and writing these stories. I suppose as students, they're learning a valuable lesson. If we want to be very cynical about it, this is a hard lesson to learn. So, okay, things are bad. What can we do about it?
Well, I think the first thing is we've got to get on the radar of Congress and patch some of these holes in the student privacy law. Right now, there's a very vigorous debate going on around the country about student privacy, but it's an incomplete debate. People are really freaked out, in some cases justifiably so, about student data falling into the hands of marketers and companies that are out there trying to sell data and harvest data for various commercial purposes. That's a very valid and understandable concern, and those folks have gotten the ear of Congress. And I would predict that we're going to see a bill in the next year or two. In fact, the White House has thrown its support behind it to tighten up the FERPA privacy statute to restrict the distribution of confidential student data. That's a perfectly valid thing to do, but it would be a tragedy if we walked away from FERPA thinking we'd fixed it there. We've got to have a comprehensive overhaul of that statute so that it's clear that confidential education records really are only those that are educational in nature and not things like, for instance, athletes' parking tickets. That's one where colleges often fight journalists tooth and nail to try to hold back on records. I'm working with a parent right now in California who's literally being told that the results of her children's high school swimming meets are confidential FERPA records because they have students' names in them. You know, there's this joke that a good prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Well, a good college attorney can get a ham sandwich classified as a FERPA record. And we've just got to get Congress to overhaul and rewrite that terribly flawed statute. That's a great starting point. And then I would say, we've got to fix the loopholes in state shield laws and reporters' privilege laws so that any journalist, even a student journalist who's not working for a paycheck, can claim the reporters' privilege and protect confidences and sources.
This is somewhat relatable. Like, again, when I was at the Connection newspaper, I was there during when the D.C. shooter was going on, and there was a lot of fear that was going on, a lot of fear about public safety of our students at the bus stops, and it occurred during football playoff season, and our sports reporters. And these aren't student reporters. These are professional reporters that contacted the school system and said, hey, you know, when's this game going to play? And they said, oh, well, we don't want to, you know, distribute that information for public safety reasons because we're concerned about our students. And, of course, our reporters were able to look online and the coach had posted it on the website. So,
yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard in the 21st century when everybody is walking around with a supercomputer in his pocket to keep secrets anymore.
Right.
And that's, you know, I don't want to be totally pessimistic here. The fact is that I really think we're in the last generation of censorship in schools and colleges. We really are, not because schools and colleges are all of a sudden going to have some First Amendment renaissance and become constitutional zealots, but just because they're going to recognize that it's futile. I mean, it's like holding the ocean back with your fingers to try to keep a secret in a school or on a college campus. And really the best thing that a school or college can do is to embrace journalism, because journalism acts as rumor control. It acts as a truth squad. You know, in the absence of good, high quality quality journalism, rumors run rampant, people speculate. Oftentimes, their imagination fills in the gaps in ways that are worse than reality. And so at that time, solid, accountable, fact-checked journalism is really the institution's own best friend.
Yeah, truth is a really good scrub brush.
Exactly, it
gets rid of all of the speculation and fear and everything.
Exactly.
Truth opens up a lot of doors and makes a lot of things accessible. So, your advice for a young journalist who's up against a problem is it who's trying to get information from the school about, I don't know, school safety, or you know, I should go back and talk about, you had written a story for Education Week about student censorship. And there are several different cases on that. Can you sort of talk about some of those that you mentioned?
Yeah, I think one that sticks in my mind that's always going to haunt me is there was a student journalist covering her school board doing exactly what we want professional journalists to do, except there were no professional journalists covering that school board anymore because newsrooms have been so hollowed out by layoffs and downsizing. So the student is literally the only person covering this particular school board meeting for her community. It's discussed in open discussion in a school board meeting that the superintendent has a number of employee grievances that have been filed against him. And the student just wants to write a fact-based news story about what she heard at this meeting. She's told by people in authority at the school district that she's not allowed to do that because we don't let students talk about personnel issues, that they're too mature and too sensitive for students to talk about, even personnel issues that bear directly on the quality of the education they're receiving. So fortunately, SPLC was able to get the student to volunteer. Your attorney from a New York law firm came down, devoted a lot of volunteer time to meeting and negotiating with the school district to get that story belatedly published to the point where the professional news media in the community actually had to follow it and acknowledge being scooped. But there's a postscript to that. The postscript to it is that immediately after that story ran and the school year ended, the journalism advisor lost his job and wasn't brought back the next year. And the journalism program has taken a really terrible hit because of it. I mean, that example amplifies the kinds of censorship cases that are making our phones ring hundreds and hundreds of times a year. Schools are just using their censorship authority for purposes of image control because they're so obsessed with looking good in the eyes of the public, and they're putting image ahead of high-quality education and often ahead of the well-being of their own students.
Is technology changing this at all? I mean, you touched on it before, the fact that there's so much information that's available, that these students are on social media, that they're tweeting out photos. There's all this stuff that's in the public realm. I mean, is it making things better? Is it, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
It can, and I think ultimately it will once school administrators sort of acclimate themselves to the new world that they live in. And the fact of the matter is, even though students have access to more channels of communication than ever before, they're really fans of those on-campus newspapers. Those newspapers are really durable things, and young people, contrary to what our stereotypes might tell us, they really actually like the paper and ink product because they see it as being reliable and credible. They know very well that any old fool can throw up anything on social media. And so they rely on and they trust the fact that something on paper and ink has been vetted, has been fact-checked, has been edited by people, and it has a veracity to it, has reliability to it. And so the fact that a newspaper is censored really does matter. It matters because students uniquely put their trust in that print product to tell them the real story. And if the story they're getting has been sanitized, then it's going to mislead them. So I think ultimately schools will wake up and colleges will wake up and realize that there are so many other channels for people to get information out that ultimately it is futile and pointless, and often it's self-defeating. It winds up calling more attention to the story and putting a big neon arrow on it when they censor it, because there's nothing that the public likes less than being told by the government what they can and can't read.
No. So how long have you been doing this?
I've been doing it 7 years now. SPLC's been around for 40 years, and I've been the director for 7.
So in that 7 years, if you kind of look back over it, what do you feel, or what do you think that the students who run into these situations and have to go through this ordeal and actually have maybe take them to court or end up running against a brick wall and can't, you know, move the story forward. What do you see, or what have you seen the way they sort of react to that and it affects them?
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to push people in one of two extreme directions. Either being censored and being obstructed completely turns them off. It sort of civically disengages them. It flips that off switch and it causes people to say, well, the heck with it. I can't fight City Hall and there's no point in trying anymore. And they just wander off and they do something else with their lives. And that's really discouraging and unfortunate that that happens. On the other hand, there are the people who get galvanized by this, for whom that's their crucible moment. And they decide, this is what I'm going to devote my life to, is seeking truth. And I've seen many of them who actually find it a life-changing moment, a change in direction, where it launches them on a career either in investigative journalism or in the law. I remember very well one of the earlier cases I worked on out of Missouri. This young woman, Nikki McGee, was a high school junior. She was a cheerleader at the high school. So the opposite of a rabble rouser, the opposite of a subversive. It was literally a high school cheerleader who also was the editor of her newspaper. Just wanted to write stories about the fact that tattooing was popular at her school. Was going to write stories and photos about tattooing. The school principal said, no, that's thuggish. That's indicative of gang behavior. We're not allowing any tattoos in the pages of our publication. She fought him all the way up to the school board, went to the news media, and actually ended up the school board sided with authority, as they so often do. But that galvanized Nikki, and it set her on a course where she decided she was going to study investigative journalism. She went to the University of Missouri, one of the top J schools in America. I have no doubt that that experience, having one of the all-time greatest admission essays to write, was one of the things that got her into that top school, then got admitted to the master's program at Northwestern, where she is now one of the other top journalism schools in America. So she is going to be a highly trained tigress when she gets out of this, and probably the worst nightmare of school districts everywhere.
So that should be the lesson here for educators and administrators who sort of fight off young journalists. That you're either failing your job by discouraging a student from learning and advancing in their career pursuits, turning them off to civic involvement, or you turn them into monsters to come after you and maybe expose you in some other way. I mean, that's what you're faced with. That's what we've got to change the system here. So how can people get involved in your organization? How can people get involved in their own communities in sort of promoting this?
Sure. Well, the Student Press Law Center is online at www.splc.org. An easy way is just to subscribe online to the news alerts that we send out, where we cover stories like this around the country. Oftentimes, it's public pressure, emails, letters, phone calls that helps turn around situations like this from concerned citizens who oppose censorship and who oppose closed-door government. We're on Twitter at SPLC, and of course, we tweet out a lot of news about open government and censorship issues there. You know, one of the things we need the most is just for people who hear about these situations to bring them forward and bring them to our attention. It is possible through state legislation to actually improve press freedom. Right now, as we're talking, I'm going to get on a plane tomorrow morning and fly up to Bismarck, North Dakota, so I can testify at the North Dakota State Legislature in favor of a student press rights bill. There are 7 states around the country that have given students enhanced press freedom by state statute above and beyond what the federal constitution provides. And it looks like North Dakota is going to become that 8th state. There are really none in this area. Massachusetts is the closest one in our part of the country here. And there's no reason why we should be lagging behind Kansas and Iowa and North Dakota. Massachusetts should have one of these. Delaware should have one of these. Gosh knows, Virginia should have one of these. DC actually already has it by school board policy, although it's not codified in statute. But we've got over 170 years of combined experience with these student press rights statutes around the country. And that 170 years of experience has taught us that the only thing you get is better journalism. You do not get any of the horribles that are predicted when you give students their rights. What you get is better quality journalism, because young people take ownership of their publications and take pride in them, and they produce really substantive, topical, high-quality journalism.
As we were walking in here, I mentioned that it was Sunshine Week. What does Sunshine Week mean to you, sir?
Well, Sunshine Week was started by the American Society of News Editors as recognition of the importance of open government to a free society. And really, you know, openness in government, transparency is the backbone of democracy. It is the right of access to information is the right that makes every other right possible. Even the right of free expression depends on knowing what to speak about. If you're not allowed into government meetings, if you're not given access to government records, then you really can't engage intelligently as a citizen. So even though the right of access to public records isn't memorialized in the Constitution, I think Mr. Jefferson and Madison overlooked that one because they didn't have quite so literate a population as we did. But even though it's not memorialized in the Constitution, it's an absolutely foundational right that unfortunately is increasingly under attack around the country by exemption after exemption after exemption being pushed by special interest groups and being enabled by a weakened media. You know, it used to be that there were very, very influential state press associations that could lobby against more and more exemptions to state public records acts. But those press associations, like the news organizations that financially support them, have really taken quite a hit in our 21st century economy. And so there are fewer and fewer watchdogs looking out for bad legislation that takes records off of the out of the public's scrutiny and puts them behind closed doors.
Yeah. And a segment of our audience are young people who are students or people who were just recently out of college who, you know, worked for a college publication and everything. But, you know, the fight goes on in all newsrooms to try to bring access to these public records, to make it easier for us to get this information. And it's a fight everywhere. You mentioned Virginia, that we should have a student rights bill for Virginia. We should have more FOIA in Virginia for police records, et cetera. We've talked about that a couple of times on the podcast, this area. But, I mean, the fight is in there in a contracted news media is creating an environment where it's really hard for us to cover the state houses, to cover the local communities. And if we're up against people who aren't going to be giving us our public records, things that we're supposed to have access to, you know, just makes our job that much harder. And it makes it more important for us to fight to do that.
Yeah, the one thing I'm really encouraged by is that all around the country, there are these sort of civic hackathons going on.
Yeah.
You have citizens getting engaged in kind of amateur acts of data journalism in a way that people were not because they didn't have access to high-powered computers and high-speed internet connections before. And so I think there's a growing appreciation among just the average citizen of the power of access to government data and the knowledge base that can be built if we can get our hands on it. So there is an appetite out there for this information. We just have to make get more accessible. And because we don't have nearly the number of salaried professionals to go out there and dig up the data, and we don't have nearly the wherewithal to sue for access to it, we just have to make it more readily available from the get-go. I mean, there's no reason why in 21st century America, when a police department creates a police record or a police
right.
report, that ought not be in real time uploaded to the internet where everybody can read it rather than having to be extracted from them like a wisdom tooth.
Yeah, and I went to an event a few months ago where they were talking about different strategies for data, and there were a couple of people there from the Washington Post, and they were talking about the simple problem they had of getting the crime report from multiple communities, and they were getting it in different forms, and some were resistant and some wouldn't provide them with all of the information. This is, you know, information that people care about and that people look for in the newspaper, the crimes that are in their neighborhood, you know, information that they should be able to access that is being held back from them. So I can go on and rant and rave, but this is, I think the stuff that you guys are doing is really admirable, and you know, it's heartening to hear that there are students out there who are fighting for their rights, and that there are people out there to help them, that there are volunteer lawyers out there to help them, which is great. But so what's next for you, sir? You said you're going out to Bismarck?
Yeah, going to North Dakota to testify in front of the Senate Education Committee. There's a student press rights bill that has passed the House of Representatives there overwhelmingly, 92-0, no
oh,
negative
excellent.
Votes. And if the Senate follows suit, then North Dakota will join the list of states that have repealed the Hazelwood Rule by action of state statute. The Hazelwood Rule, I should explain, the Supreme Court decided a case called Hazelwood in 1988. It's a case that diminished students' First Amendment rights when they're publishing in school-operated journalistic publications. It's become, over the years, unfortunately, an excuse for image-motivated censorship of all sorts under this guise of legitimate educational reasoning. But most of the censorship is not, of course, educationally based at all. Most of it is trying to deny the public access to truthful information about the shortcomings of schools. We all know that. And we all know that after 26 years of experience under the Hazelwood standard, that students have become more civically disengaged. It's just no mystery that young people are less and less interested in public affairs when they're forbidden from having conversations about them during the school day. And we've got to turn that around. And that starts with bringing the discussion of social and political issues back into the pages of newspapers where it belongs.
So we've been talking about school-sanctioned newspapers. Do you at all deal with student alternative papers, papers that people publish not under the auspices of the school system?
We do. We'll help anybody that's doing anything that seems even remotely journalistic. And increasingly, of course, that means social media. I mean, if you look around at the federal courts around the country, the number one issue that's tying up federal courts all across the country is figuring out how much authority a school or college can exercise over what young people publish when they're on social media on their own personal time. I mean, that's one of the great ironies of the internet is people assumed. And if you look at some of the developing world, the internet has been this force, this liberating force where it's democratizing countries by enabling people to communicate and share ideas in ways that were never possible before. That's all well and good. But in this country, it actually may be having the opposite effect for young people. It's actually resulting in censorship authority following them home in a way that it never did before. So there is now a growing sentiment among federal courts that speech that's posted on social media is in school speech and is governed by all the same standards as if the student said that same remark during class on school grounds during school time.
Now, is that in reaction, an anti-bullying sort of statute, like cyberbullying, where they're trying to control the speech that way?
That seems to be one of the things that's motivating the federal courts to poke holes in the First Amendment. There is an understandable sympathy for school administrators that are dealing with bullying speech. But in the cases that we've dealt with and been involved with, oftentimes it is not a matter of students bullying other students. And quite frankly, I doubt that the Student Press Law Center would ever intervene in such a case. We certainly don't advocate legalized bullying. But what we do advocate is students being able to speak candidly when they're at home on their own time about the shortcomings of schools, which might include criticizing the people who work there. And that's been one way in which schools have, in our view, completely inappropriately used their punitive authority to stop students from complaining about school conditions using social media. There was a rather well-publicized case a couple of weeks back in Miami, in which a high school principal actually brought students in and threatened them with discipline because they were using the social media platform Instagram to call attention to the fact that the school food was covered with mold and the walls and ceilings were covered with mildew and that the school was essentially filthy. And the students were using Instagram in this sort of very rudimentary journalistic way, in the way that people might in earlier time have used pamphlets or other forms of journalistic speech. These students resorted to Instagram. They were hauled into the principal's office and they were told they were making the school look bad and that they were not to publicize these defects. And fortunately, in that case, there happened to be a member of the school board who had a background in professional broadcasting and who brought this to the attention of the superintendent. The principal got a good talking to, and things were set right eventually. But that's an example of the ways in which schools are using their punitive authority to reach out into students' off-campus lives and to punish them for speech addressing matters of social and political concern.
Yeah, and that's an example of somebody looking at a problem from the wrong direction. Here's a problem with the way your school is, you know, maybe it's underfunded. Maybe you don't have the right cleaning staff or the facilities need to be updated. I mean, here's an opportunity to say, hey, look, you know, look at what these students are doing. These are the conditions they have to live in. Yes, it's embarrassing to me as an administrator to have to deal with it. But, you know, these are the realities that we deal with. And, you know, maybe that invokes some change that way. Rather than try to shut up and say there's no problem.
Yeah, I think unfortunately, and by the way, this is not limited to schools at all. This is something I hear from my friends in the professional media who deal with federal agencies all the time, that we're just dealing with this culture in which it's regarded as being a legitimate exercise of government authority to control access to information in order to protect the image of the government agency. And yeah. I mean, that was never the case even 20, 30, 40 years ago. If you had said that it was a legitimate exercise of government authority to try to make the government look good, people would have thrown you out of office. But now this has become a very accepted rationale for censorship. And unfortunately, even the public is starting to accept it, that, well, you certainly can't make the school or the college look bad. That would hurt their donations. That would hurt their rankings. We very often hear, in fact, this is a really kind of a discouraging thing about being a student journalist, is that even their own peers often don't support them. You've got journalists who'll come to me and say, hey, I've been told by my classmates that my reporting on the college or my editorial commentary about the college is devaluing their degrees because it's making people think less of the school, as if, you know, it is the classic kill the messenger mentality. And unfortunately, I think that all government agencies, but most especially schools and colleges, because they are reliant on donor funding and alumni support, they're especially image conscious and unfortunately prone to use their punitive authority to crack down on people that they believe are portraying them in a negative, although accurate, light.
Now, and we could go on and sort of talk in circles and circles about about FOIA and the lack of transparency and how hard it is to get records. We could be talking for hours and hours, but this has been great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Again, how can people find out about your organization?
Yeah, so the Student Press Law Center is online. Our website is www.splc.org. We're on Twitter @SPLC. And we'd certainly love to have folks get in touch with us if they heard of situations going on school and college campuses that they think could deserve some attention, because we, too, like to shine the spotlight on wrongdoing by schools and colleges and try to advocate for better public policies that give people access to the information they need.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.